Jan Swofford is an American composer and the author of biographies of Brahms, Charles Ives, and Beethoven. This is Jan Swofford. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank. All right. So I am here with Jan Swofford. Sir, thank you very much for joining me today.
Good to be here, Duncan.
So we were just talking. I wanted to get your take on a number of things. You had written a biography of Beethoven, Anguish and Triumph, and that was how I had originally gotten to know you. And I saw this great YouTube video you did at 92nd Street Y, where it's a psychobiography of Beethoven, and you talked to a psychiatrist and sort of walked through his life. When you were writing this book, because so much has been written about Beethoven already, and you are a composer, what was it that you felt like you could bring to the topic of Beethoven that had not been brought there before?
One of the things, I guess, is that a lot of Beethoven's sketches exist. He didn't tend to throw away any piece of paper he wrote on. He just kept them. So there have been some studies of the sketches, but not really all that much. And the main ones were done in the 19th century. And I guess what I'll say is that as a composer, I have a different view of a piece of music than a performer does, or a musicologist, or a theorist. A piece of music, a published piece by Beethoven or anybody else, has a Talmudic finality to it, and you are devoted to what is there on the page, and you may add to it what you know about the composer and their history and psychology, but it's a settled final thing, and it's that way for a theorist as well. For me as a composer, a piece of music that's published was something that I see as having been made one note at a time, having been conceived and sort of pounded out of material, pounded into shape. You know, when pieces first, I know that how pieces first occur to you, they're vague. Benjamin Britten said once that writing a piece is like glimpsing something distantly in a fog, and the closer you get to it, the more distinct it gets until you're right on it, and then you see what it actually is and its completion. And I look at every piece of music that way. So one of the questions I had, I don't have theories as a biographer, I have questions. And one of the, did we just disappear, by the way?
No.
Okay, my screen just changed.
Oh, okay.
Okay, I thought maybe we'd gotten disconnected. But anyway, I'm going to pick up right where I was.
Sure.
Let me try to figure out exactly.
Well, you were saying that a lot of people, a lot of musicologists and theoreticians and performers look at this, and they look at his sketches, and they have this kind of reverential sort of hero-worshipping attitude towards it, almost, of like, okay, this guy could not have made a mistake. He was not even human. He was a god. And you, as an artist yourself, realize that, okay, no, this person was a human, and like any other human artist, goes through a process of evolution with each piece. When you're looking at some of his early sketches, or, you know, as a composer, how do you look at it? Do you look at, like, do you see, like, frustration in there? Do you see, you know, like a discovering process? What was his process like?
Two things. I see a process. The question I had at the beginning, I don't have theories about music or biography as much as I have questions when I go into a thing. And one of the questions I would ask about his sketches is, what did he know and when did he know it? In other words, at what point was he just kind of putting down an idea that struck him that he thought was interesting? And at what point was he actually working on a concept, even though he's a long way from getting it realized? And what I discovered in looking at the sketches, which is quite different than the way the sketches were looked at in the classic studies of the 19th century, is that early on in the process, when sketches are beginning to accumulate, he knows a lot about that piece. He doesn't know, he's not there yet. He has a long way to go, but he knows what the quality and the nature and the expressive basis of this piece is already. So he's working on a concept. And later I found some testimony, some evidence of that by somebody who knew Beethoven, who says the same thing, that he is planning on a concept. And I'll give you the classic example. Is the Eroica symphony, let's say the first movement of the Eroica. Well, let's say the whole thing. I know how that piece happened. Well, that's in the sketches. And then you can reconstruct the kind of process. It began with this bass line, and as weird as it sounds, because what begins a piece is often something very small, tiny. It began with a bass line in a ballet of his, and a tune, a little dance that ended a ballet he wrote. And he wrote some variations for piano that we now call the Eroica variations, which were a series of variations over that very simple bass line. And I think by the time he was writing those variations, or anyway, by the time he finished, he already had an idea. I'm going to write a symphony, and something like these variations for piano over that bass line are going to be the last movement. So the Eroica started back to front. He started with an idea for the last movement. And at some point early in the process, maybe at the same time, he said, maybe suggested by the name of the ballet, which was Prometheus. And he said, I'm going to write a Promethean figure as a kind of gigantic figure who brings gifts to humanity in a larger sense. There's the old Greek myth, but that's a different thing. He said, I'm going to write a piece about the Prometheus of our age, Napoleon. I'm going to write a symphony called Bonaparte.
Right.
And this is going to be the last movement, some variations over the bass line. At that point, he said, knowing Beethoven, having watched his craftsmanship and look at the sketches, and knowing that as a composer, what you do to find where you go next is you base it on what you have. And what he had to start with was an idea for the finale. He didn't write it out yet, but he knew exactly what it was going to be like. It was going to be like the Eroica piano variations. Is all this making sense so far?
Yeah. So can I get
this,
like,
a clear? This is going to take a while, but anyway.
No. You're good. But when you say these sketches, is he writing like sheet music at this point, or is he like jotting down words, or what would a sketch look like in this case?
Some of his sketches are words, but the Eroica ones that we have are mostly what we call in one line.
Okay.
And what we call a continuity sketch, meaning it's just one line. And so people often sometimes think, well, that's, he was just thinking about this one line. The one line is just there to get the continuity and remind him, because what he's hearing in his head is a whole orchestra. That one line represents the whole orchestra, if that makes sense.
Yeah, sure.
And it's in one line just because it's a kind of shorthand. So he says, knowing Beethoven, you build what you're going to do on what you have. He said, now I've got to make a first movement. I've got to make the rest of the piece, and somehow or other, it's going to be derived from the finale, it's going to be derived from that bass line. And I knew already what I was going to find, though I had to prove it out, and I did, I think. He took the bass line that he started with, the Prometheus bass. Bum, 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 bum. Simplest thing in the world. As I said, it's a nothing on which you can direct anything. And he began to play around with that bass line until he came up with a theme for the first movement, which was da di da 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 dee dum da dum, which became what I call the hero theme of the first movement. The first movement begins with two big chords, setting the mood of big heroic music, and then there's this quiet kind of shimmering, and you hear that theme, which is made from the last movement theme, which will be its goal. And so I looked at the sketches for the first movement, and I saw, you know, having looked at the final piece of the first movement, I knew that it has this exploratory quality. It's as if it's enormously restless. It's moving from one idea to another, and nothing settles down. And the way I put it is that the what's called the exposition section, which is usually fairly coherent and settled ideas that are then developed in the middle development section. The whole piece is like a development section, very restless way. And in the sketches, there are especially four long continuity sketches toward the first part of the first movement. What I could see was that he already was working toward this idea of a restless movement that never settles down. He didn't know what to do yet. He didn't know what was going to go in there, though he had very particular ideas. So in one sketch, you see this bomb, he's taking the theme, bomb, bomb, and then walking it up step by step. Da di da 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 di da 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 di da 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 di da 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 di da da, like that. Well, in fact, that's going to end up in the middle of the piece in the development section. It was originally one of the sketches for the first part, the exposition. But again, he has a concept and he's working toward it already in the piece. And every time I looked at sketches of his, I found the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that's something I know as a composer. And the classic sketches from the 19th century by a guy named Nottebohm, who was not a composer, had... They're great studies, but they have a fundamental misconception. And that is that each sketch was first the final thing, and then he reached a point of sort of boom, here it is, here's the final version, here's the perfect thing, and there it is. The reality is it was much more fluid than that. Sometimes in the final manuscript, there are still sketches. There's a cello sonata where he wrote a complete revision of the development section on top of the first version, just right over the top. He was mainly changing around what he was giving the cello and the piano, but it was still a complete revision. And sometimes you see sketches at the bottom of his manuscripts. Though most of his manuscripts are actually quite clear, they were settled. But what I'm getting at is Nottebohm was wrong about this kind of single direction moving toward perfection. It was a much more floundering around kind of thing. Early on as a composer that from the beginning of the time that I started seriously analyzing his pieces, I realized that each piece has a very small collection of ideas, most of which are things that happen right at the beginning of the piece, and he makes the rest of the piece from those ideas. It was absolutely clear to me that he did that, and yet this is still not an idea that's accepted about his music in some respects. It's the unity of his pieces. And as he said at one point, he didn't say much about his music at all, but at one point he did say, it's my habit always to keep the whole in view. A piece for him was a continuing development of a very few small, simple ideas. And the most obvious example is da-da-da-dum.
Right.
The beginning of the Fifth Symphony. And that motif never stops in the first movement, but it is developed and changed and transformed to the end of the piece. And the second movement becomes bum, 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 or dum, bum, ba-da-da-dum. And the third movement becomes da-da-da-dum, 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 ba-da-ba-bum. And the last movement becomes tilly-dum, 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 and the piece ends ba-ba-ba-bum, ba-ba-ba-bum. You see what I'm getting at. It's the simplest idea in the world used as the basis of a whole piece. In that case, it was a rhythmic idea.
That's okay. So there are a number of things that I wanted to ask you there. One, you mentioned the Eroica Symphony, the Napoleon Symphony, and there's this famous story about Beethoven hearing that Napoleon crowned himself emperor, and now he is furious at him because he thinks he's betrayed these ideals of liberty and democracy and so forth, and he scratches Napoleon's name off the symphony or something like that. And
that is a true story.
That's a true story. Okay, can you talk about that a little bit?
Well. I think it's a great example of Beethoven's integrity. The piece was called, he wrote every note of that third symphony as a piece called Bonaparte. And a student of his came in one day and the manuscript score of the thing was sitting on a desk and it said symphony entitled Bonaparte. And student Reese said, oh, did you hear Bonaparte just crowned himself emperor? Now, Beethoven, in this piece about Bonaparte, he was planning, at this point they weren't fighting, Austria and France were not fighting. There was a period of peace. He was planning to go to Paris, Beethoven, on a tour, and I suspect he was going to try to find Bonaparte in person and say, hey, I wrote this piece about you. Why don't you give me a job?
Yeah, yeah.
And so when he heard this, it was... the idea that Napoleon had promoted himself as the completion of the French Revolution. I'm going to make better laws and peace all over Europe. And as soon as he crowned himself emperor, he made it clear that he was going to just go right back into being a hereditary founder of a dynasty of emperors. And that there was a complete contradiction of everything that the liberal factions, like people like Beethoven, believed about him and the way he had promoted himself. And you would expect Beethoven in this situation to say, well, I wrote this piece about him. I'd kind of like to maybe get a job with him some days. And maybe it's not right. So bad, but that's not what he did. He absolutely pitched a fit and understood instantly. Beethoven was very interested in politics. He talked about, somebody said that was his favorite topic of conversation. He understood instantly what this meant, and that it, and he said he's just another tyrant in it for himself. And he... the student said he ripped up the score and jumped up and down on it. I mean, not the score, the title page, of course.
Okay, sure. I was going to say it seemed a little flamboyant, but
apparently not, because the title page still exists, but the name Bonaparte has been scratched out so violently that the pen went right through the paper. And it was premiered with no title at all. And when it finally was published a few years later, it came out as Symphony Heroica, Heroic Symphony in Memory of a Great Man. And it was in memory of the man Napoleon was supposed to be, but wasn't.
Wow. That's okay. So the other thing I wanted to ask you while you were talking about his writing of that symphony, when you're saying it starts off with this bass line and he's doing all these variations on it and you know, these chords.
But backwards in that case, the yes. bass line is going to be the foundation of finale, but he made that bass line into the theme of the first movement, which then became the effective theme. Anyway, sorry.
Well, no. It's the reason I mentioned that is because that does not sound that far off from the way that like popular music today sounds like. You have a bass line, you have chords and a melody, but I would assume, I don't know the intellectual argument or the artistic argument, or I can't deliver it as well, of why popular music would fall short of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. I know your feelings on that, but I'm wondering, is there any popular music as a composer and as someone who has lived a life of music, is there any popular music out there like the Beatles or, Kanye West or anyone that you listen to that you go, okay, this actually is interesting and accomplished on a musical level?
Well, a lot of it's accomplished on a musical level. There's not that much pop music that interests me. And like most people, the pop music I do like is the stuff I grew up with.
Right.
And I was into in college and shortly after. So I'm really into the Beatles and Creedence and the Stones and stuff of that era. I keep trying to find new popular music to get into and not succeeding very well. I've been listening to a lot of Bela Fleck, actually, lately. A lot of Bela Fleck.
Oh, really?
But partly because he is so enormously broad in what he's done. He's done everything from versions of Bach to bluegrass to jazz and everything in between. Just astounding range of things. You talk about the bass lines. Bass lines in pop music are not very interesting. Pop music is written on chords. And the bass line is just the base of that chord. I don't know of... many, if any, rock and roll songs I have ever heard that have a melodic bass line, there's no reason why they shouldn't. It just doesn't occur to anybody.
Some Beatles songs have melodic.
Are very straightforward and simple. And pop music to me, I have no problem with pop music at all. And I'm interested in nearly every kind of music, really.
Yeah.
I'm involved in Western pop music. I'm involved in Indian music and Chinese and Japanese and African, and with absolute fascination. To me, the most complex and rich tradition outside Western music is the Indian classical tradition, which is extraordinary and has a depth of theoretical thought that is equal to the West. Pop music to me is fun, and it's expressing simple everyday emotions and something to get drunk and dance to, and it's sexy, and it's, and I don't take pop music too seriously, because I don't think it should be, in the same way that classical music, by and large, classical music can be anything. It can be from fun to profound to tragic. It can be ugly and horrifying and terrifying, in the same way that Shakespeare and Greek tragedies are. It can be anything. Pop music to me and classical music overlap in certain ways, in interesting ways. Have I been inspired by pop music and my music? I'll tell you one thing. Current composers make a fetish of saying that their music is related to rock and roll. I once, about 20 years ago, went to a presentation to orchestra managers by a series of composers who wrote orchestra music and were trying to pitch their music to them. And there was about 8 composers. And I was the only one who did not say that my music was directly related to rock and roll. Wow. The only one. And that was 20 years ago. And it's the same now. And I was the only one who no manager talked to.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I got absolutely nothing out of that.
Do you think they were just lying when they said that?
I was inspired to one piece by the bass line, actually, of Every Little Thing She Does Is Magic by The Police, because I was eating in a barbecue restaurant and that came on the jukebox. And actually, I was interested in the bass line. I said, that's one of the most interesting bass lines I've ever heard in a rock tune. And I was interested in the idea that the bass line was moving around and the harmony wasn't. And that just sparked an idea that became my piece called Midsummer Variations.
Do you think that when
those
other...
It sounds nothing like rock and roll, even though there's a certain amount of Balinese music in it.
Do you think those other composers, when they said that they were inspired by rock and roll, do you think they were just like making that up to sound like egalitarian?
It was trendy then, it was trendy now, and some of it was probably baloney, and maybe some of it wasn't.
Okay.
They knew what was trendy, let's put it that way, and so did the managers, because they were really excited by this. But even 20 years ago, that was not new among young composers. And I, you know, sometimes I listen to the pieces that where they make, you know, academe these days is absolutely kowtowing to popular culture. And I have no problems with popular culture, but to me, it is what it is. And to take it seriously in the same way that you take Shakespeare is just does harm to both popular culture and to Shakespeare. To make rock and roll into something that is high art, to me, does damage to rock and roll and to high art.
Can I give you an example of a song that I thought that was popular music that I thought was musically interesting, but also had interesting ideas to it? There's a line in a Kanye West song where he's talking about it's this song called Power, and he's talking about it's really about the duality of fame, of being this intoxicating experience and also having many dark emotional pitfalls. And he's saying, I've got the power to make your life so exciting. And he's calling this out to a bunch of people. And the word so exciting repeats and it blends into the words. It goes from so exciting to suicidal. And I just thought that was a really... I thought that was at least a clever notion to put into a pop song that kind of captures that duality.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It reminds me of the Beatles. One of the great things about the Beatles is their irony. And one of the great 60s anthems is All You Need Is Love.
Yes.
But so they're sort of chanting this, All You Need Is Love. And sometimes the answer to that is this old-fashioned, corny British music call,
Yeah.
So it is, yeah, all you need is love, but it's also, isn't this a corny sentiment? And it's both. And they're very good at that kind of musical irony. And there's a different kind of irony in Penny Lane of putting a Bach trumpet into a pop tune. Right. That's not disrespecting Bach. It is adding a layer of irony and musical interest and musical texture to what is otherwise just kind of a feel-good tune.
Yeah. Okay. I'm glad to hear that, because otherwise I was.
By the way, we should do a show sometime on popular music. Though I know very little of it the last 30 years.
I would love.
But I know the Beatles kind of a lot, and have a lot to say about them. And the people I know, I have a lot to say about. Let's put it that way. Even though my knowledge of the pop music scene is not encyclopedic by any means.
That's
and a lot of it I just get weary of. I got into classical music because I was listening to Elvis, but I just got bored with it. And I discovered after that most of the pop music I listened to, I'd like it, and then I'd listen to it five times and I was tired of it. Whereas classical music to me just got deeper and more mysterious the more I listened to it. It grew rather than diminishing.
Well, that's the thing, is that in Beethoven's time, if you were a classical musician, that was essentially the mainstream of music at that point in time, correct?
Not really. I mean, there was folk music and all kinds of music, and it was, what he was writing was more middle class and up, amateurs. I mean, remember that in Beethoven's time, there was no kind of concert scene the way there is now. Most chamber music, string quartets, piano sonatas were never played in public. Only one Beethoven piano sonata was played in public in his lifetime. And the world's first string quartet public concert series was his quartet in his lifetime. And it didn't last for long. His music was spread by sheet music, mainly among amateurs. And some of those amateurs were very, very good, but they were enormously enthusiastic. They did music all the time. Music was like, for people who were interested in it, was like television now. It's something you did every day and you really worked at it. Sometimes some people did. So sometimes people say Beethoven was a rock star. He wasn't, because rock star is a function of modern media. Mm. And there was no such thing. And very few people got to hear him play. Mostly his music was spread in sheet music. And it's a whole different scene than now. But we don't know a lot of the popular music then, because A, some of it didn't survive, and B, it just isn't very interesting to us.
Yeah. Well, but why do you think that it doesn't seem like in Beethoven's time, he was early on, they said that he could be the next Mozart, but there doesn't seem to be a person nowadays up and coming who folks are, you know, have a chatter about and say, you know, oh, this could be the next Beethoven, or this could be the next, you know, Stravinsky or whomever.
The phrase "the next Mozart" has been used in every generation since Mozart, I promise you.
Okay, yeah.
It just has rarely turned out to be true. That was what was said of Beethoven. It was said of Saint-Saëns, who was a very good composer, but he was no Mozart. And it's been said of a lot of people who never got anywhere. Part of it is that there was a mechanism in place in Beethoven and Mozart's day of patrons and musical circles and amateurs desperate for new music. Most music played in those days was new music. And that fostered people like Beethoven and Mozart. That simply doesn't exist anymore. What we have now is you pay to go to music school and you pay a whole lot of money, and then you come out and you promote yourself to a mostly indifferent public and to musicians, many of whom don't care about new music, but some do. And the ones who do are getting hundreds and hundreds of pieces all the time. You know, I sent my stuff to a string quartet and I got to know them a little later, and they showed me a in those days it was cassettes. They showed me a cabinet they had made specially for cassettes that composers sent to them, and there were hundreds of them.
Wow.
And they wanted me to see it because I had sent them my cassettes. Did they listen to them all? I doubt it. I can't imagine they did.
Well, but that's what I'm wondering though, is why is that the case, that the majority of music that is played by symphonies is not current, like contemporaneous composers? You know what I mean? Like, why is that?
Well, it goes back to the 19th century when there was a growing divide between audiences and composers. And also Beethoven was the first generation to composers. The idea of writing a body of music that would stay in the repertoire from then on was brand new in Beethoven's day. The first composer who was never forgotten, just stayed in the repertoire, was Handel. And he died when Haydn was already in his 20s and Mozart was 3 or 4. And so the idea that your music could be immortal and could be part of a standing repertoire was quite new in Beethoven's day. Beethoven was intensely aware of that. And that idea that there's a standing repertoire, which is gradually, slowly growing, of favorite pieces, already in the 1830s and 40s was beginning to edge out newer composers. Meanwhile, newer composers, mainly because of the example of Beethoven, were writing pieces that were longer, more challenging, more complicated, partly because composers now said, if they don't understand me in my lifetime, they will later in posterity. So that, and audiences, you know, when Brahms was getting started in Leipzig, was very conservative. They were mostly interested in old music. And Brahms was considered really difficult stuff, and he was booed off the stage when he premiered his first piano concerto at Leipzig. Wow. I don't mean booed off, he was hissed off the stage. So Brahms contributed to that because he believed the past was infinitely superior to the present. So he was okay with the standing repertoire, even though that was one of his biggest problems, getting his symphonies were considered too intellectual in his lifetime. His violin, Brahms' violin concerto, one of the most glorious, beautiful pieces ever written for the violin, never caught on in his lifetime. And then in the 20th century, composers were used to that, and they just said, we're going to write what we want, and the hell with the public, but finally, basically. Not every composer by any means, not even most composers, but some of the most important composers, like Schoenberg, in a sense, said the hell with the public, I'm going to write what I believe in, and maybe people will come around. And with many composers like Stravinsky and even Bartok, they did. With Schoenberg, let's put it this way, I've seen 20 years ago, Mitsuko Ushida played the Schoenberg Piano Concerto at the BSO and got a standing ovation, so that's possible. Yeah. But basically, at the same time, I was at a BSO concert and they played the Janáček Sinfonietta, written in the 20s. I mean, the Glagolitic Mass. And an elderly lady in the elevator said, I don't like this modern music. And I refrain from saying anything.
Yeah.
And it also doesn't sell. Beethoven, everybody knows that Beethoven sells, puts butts in the seats. And a few modern pieces like the Bartok Concerto of Orchestra and the Rite of Spring, Stravinsky and things like that may, but not as much. So it's economic too. And I was working for a manager of the Bach and Handel Society here, Handel and Haydn Society. And it was when a BSO was looking for a conductor. I said, why don't they hire Esa-Pekka Salonen? And then she said, never happen. He plays too much contemporary music. The board will never stand for it.
Wow. Yeah, I mean,
I have to say, though, that audiences, I think, are much more open than they were 25 years ago. I really think so.
How so?
They've just heard more of it. And they hear more of it in movies, too. A lot of contemporary music techniques are used in movies, not only horror movies by any means, but the sounds people are used to now, and they weren't as used to them 25 years ago. They are now because of movies.
What do you think of John Cage, that composer who wrote all that really dissonant, weird sounding music? And
that doesn't really describe Cage. Cage believed that any sound at all was equally valid. He made no judgments. Therefore, he wrote, his music always was involved with chance to some degree. So he wrote it sometimes in very particular ways, but one of his pieces is for 12 radios. And there's a score in which you manipulate the radios in very specific ways, turning volume up and down and changing channels and so forth. But what comes out is whatever happens to be on the radio. And his famous piano piece, 4 minutes and 32 seconds or whatever the seconds are, where you just sit there and don't play and the music is whatever sounds are made in the hall. And Cage was very much Zen in his attitudes, and he had this all-embracing attitude, but mainly he did not want music to be moving, expressive in any way, and he didn't want composers to manipulate the audience with their music, and so therefore there was always an element of chance in his mature music. I'm not interested in the music of Cage,
yeah,
because everything he hated, which is manipulative music and music that has enormous emotional clout and intellectual clout, is what he hated, and that's exactly what I love about music. I'm in it for the emotion.
Yeah.
And the reason I love Western classical music more than any other, even though I love a lot of music, most music, is because it's, to me, the most emotional, most deeply emotional, and the most mysterious. And the most, after that, the most interesting intellectually and technically and so forth as a composer. So I don't care about Cage, except he wrote wonder. He's a great storyteller, and his books are full of wonderful stories. I like his books.
Yeah. No, I mean, I just remember trying to listen to some of John Cage's music, and it seemed like he was more of a philosopher, or like I don't want to say performance artist. But it seemed,
I agree.
You know what I mean? Like less of a forthright musician.
Absolutely. I mean, he always said he didn't have any talent. I think it's true right. For music. And I think he had enormous influence on performance art. He had it back in the days of Happenings in the 70s. He was a major figure. I think he's been very useful to composers without talent ever since.
Oh, really? In a good or a bad way?
Use the example of Cage to create manifestations of any kind, whatever, whether you have any gift for it or not. But then there are plenty of people these days who believe there's no such thing as talent in any field, so that's a whole other thing. And I think that's absolute nonsense. To say that talent is not enough to make you good, and talent is not enough to make you a genius, I agree with that. But you cannot be a genius without a hell of a lot of inborn talent. Talent is inborn, but it has to be developed, and it has to be nurtured, and it has to be helped out. And you have to be a genius. Part of it is you have to be lucky.
Yeah, well, that seems to be the case with things like a few select fields, especially like music or math, where there are three-year-olds out there who are able to play the piano better than I will ever be able to play it in my life.
That's right. That's called talent. And that, yes. In the case of performing, it's also called coordination. And I've finally realized in old age that I practice piano as much as a lot of people who are much better piano players than I am. And I've got a lot of talent for music. Not Mozart by any means, but a lot of talent. But I've never been anything but at my best a mediocre pianist, just because I'm a klutz, you know.
Yeah.
just not very coordinated. And that's why I'm a lousy skier and why I'm not a very good piano player.
Was Beethoven, his father seemed to be this kind of tyrannical figure and tried to make him to be this like child prodigy. Did he fit that mold? Was he, I mean, obviously he was a genius, but was he a child prodigy in the vein of Mozart?
He was a child prodigy, but not in the vein of Mozart because of dad. I mean, dad Dad was a musician enough to realize that his kid was a phenomenon, and that was very clear early on. But he wanted to make his kid into a new Mozart. And so he put him on in a program when Beethoven was 7. When Ludwig was 7, he advertised him as 6, which was the age Mozart was when he became famous. But the thing is that Leopold Mozart, the father, who was his son's only teacher, was a phenomenal musician and systematically brought up his kid with incredible influences all over Europe and trained him brilliantly. And there was nobody there to train Beethoven like that. Dad couldn't do it. And Dad early on realized that and got better teachers, but Beethoven never had a teacher as good as Leopold Mozart. All the same, when his major teacher arrived when Beethoven was 10, that teacher wrote an article saying, this kid, if he goes the way he has been, is going to be the next Mozart. And so Beethoven was, in fact, a prodigy. But the other difference is that Beethoven was absolutely determined to be a composer pianist. So he actually spent more time on piano in his teens than Mozart did. And he spent more time on piano rather than composing. So he didn't write what Beethoven wrote nearly as voluminous and sophisticated as what Mozart wrote. But as soon as Beethoven got to Vienna and studied a little bit with Haydn, he became Beethoven as a composer. He was already one of the greatest pianists in the world.
Why did Beethoven, compared to Mozart, who lived not as lengthy of a life as Beethoven, but Mozart wrote way more symphonies. Why is that? Were Mozart's symphonies just less complex?
Yeah. In a way, when Mozart started writing symphonies weren't that big a deal. They were played mostly in music rooms. There were only a few cities in Europe that had big public concerts where symphonies were played. They were played by small orchestras as part of programs that had chamber music and concertos, grab bag programs, and they were not usually played in sequence. So a symphony was something you wrote in a couple of weeks at most. You might write it occasionally. Mozart wrote one of his symphonies in 4 days. So they were not that important. The more important symphonies got, the fewer composers wrote because they spent more time on them. They became more ambitious, more serious, more complex. And the person who really made that happen was Haydn. His last 12 symphonies were, and that made the symphony for the first time, the big pieces, the king of instrumental music. And Mozart picked up on that, and his last 3 symphonies are in that vein, but only the last 3. So Haydn wrote 104 symphonies, Mozart wrote 41, and Beethoven wrote 9, which have about the same amount of stuff in them and intensity and complexity as Haydn's 104 and Mozart's 41.
Yeah.
You see what I'm getting at?
Yeah.
Where Beethoven picked up the symphony from Haydn and Mozart was, okay, this is the king of musical forms. It is the crown of my works. Neither Mozart or Haydn looked at symphonies that way. And therefore, I'm going to spend whatever time it takes on every symphony, and each one is going to be radically different than the one before.
That point right there, you saying it being radically different than it was before. I had talked a while ago to a biographer of Jackson Pollock, and Jackson Pollock, of course, had these amazing drip paintings, and they revolutionized the world of art, and they were this entirely new technique. And for the rest of his life, like the few years he had left, he really struggled with that and trying to create a new form, because he wasn't content with just repeating himself. What
I didn't know that.
And it's apparently a huge part and component in his sort of mental and physical breakdown over the rest of his life. But that I'm curious how Beethoven, I mean, was able to overcome that. Well, I mean, was it just the sheer weight of his talent, or?
Well, it was the sheer weight of his talent and his imagination and his determination. I don't think Beethoven looked at himself as a revolutionary. I ended up calling him a radical evolutionary because everything he did was founded on the past, mainly Haydn and Mozart and Bach. but he did everything they did more. So if Haydn's late symphonies are very distinct from one another, and Mozart's last three are certainly quite different from each other, he made his even more distinct. And it's very clear that each time he took up a symphony, and he said this a couple of times directly, he said, I'm going to do something very, very different. So the sixth symphony, which was written after he was already working on the fifth symphony a little bit, the sixth symphony is almost the antithesis of the fifth symphony. Everything with fifth symphony is raging and dramatic and dynamic. The sixth symphony is a pleasant day in the country.
Yeah.
And that was the point. But the reality is every one of Beethoven's, 32 piano sonatas is absolutely distinct, or at least after the first few. Every time he picked up the piano sonata, it's as if he remade the piano completely. They sound completely different. It's not just different tunes. It's a different conception of the instrument itself. And that's what Beethoven conceived his job to be, to always be doing something new. And the art scene now, and visual arts especially, you tend to find a shtick and stay with it.
Yeah.
You know, you make a soft telephone and it catches on, or you wrap something in cloth and that catches on, and you just keep doing it. It's one idea, and that's my objection to a lot of this stuff, that it's one idea just repeated over and over, because it's no longer understood to be your job is to continually reinvent yourself and reinvent your art and do new stuff.
It's particularly unfortunate in the visual arts world, because people get wrapped up in this idea of being not really even being an artist, but it's sort of after Andy Warhol, everyone just became a businessman artist or a business person artist, and everything's selling.
Given
for
that, you can repeat yourself over and over and over and make millions doing it, is the great corruption of art. It's the ultimate corruption of art.
Absolutely.
And you know, I have thought, if I ever wrote a piece that really caught on, and I have an idea that if I can bring it off, will be astounding.
There you go.
But I don't know how to do it yet, and I'm not going to talk about it. But let's say I did that, and people said, wow, and this really got around. And suddenly people were offering me a lot of money. Would I do that? It's a very good question. I like to think that I wouldn't, that I'd have the integrity to say, no, I did that, and now I'm going to do something else.
Yeah, but it's an unknowable question until it's posed to you, I suppose, you know?
Well, yeah, of course. And, you know, with millions dangling, it wouldn't be millions for a composer, but with, really don't know what you're going to do.
Right. Enough.
You realize there's a whole underground art market of stuff that most people never see, and a lot of it ends up in warehouses, and yet people are being paid millions of dollars. The art. To me, it's a horror show. It's an absolute horror show. And that maybe the only good art that's going to come out of the current process.
Yeah, it's particularly unfortunate, the idea of great art going into people's warehouses, because now it's just it's like a stock or a bond for people that it's just going to appreciate in value. And so, you know, might as well, you know, there's no point in showing it. You just want to hold on to it like you would a bar of gold, as opposed to a work of art.
Well, some of that art may be a bar that can now be art, or a pile of dirt in the corner, anything.
Yeah.
So a lot of the stuff in the warehouses is just, as far as I'm concerned, bullshit.
Yeah.
There may be good stuff in there too. Nobody. It's an investment, you know, and I know some of these, I've met some of these collectors, not many, they're not in my social circle, but, and they may be about it, but it's still an investment like any other. And that, you know, Beethoven, I think, wrote his work with absolute integrity and fearlessness and courage. And as soon as the last note was down, it became a stock and trade, and he wanted a good price for it. And he was very good at the business.
Well, that's in contrast to Mozart, right? Because Mozart was often in debt and
Yeah, but Mozart made more money than Beethoven did. He just couldn't hang on to it.
Oh,
Mozart
wow.
was paid very, very well. And he was on the verge of real prosperity when he died. He made a lot of money, and he lived very high on the hog most of the time. He was a dandy. He lived in some pretty fancy apartments. But all the same, he made a lot of money. We don't know where it went. And he may have, you know, people say he may have gambled, and that implies he's going out to casinos and throwing his money away. No, the reality is every game you played in those days, there was money on the line. If you played cards at home with your family, even, there was money on the line. And among other things, Mozart played pool. He was a billiards player. And he was passionate about it. And every time somebody who was supposed to be good got in town, he would invite them over and play, and it would have been for money. And apparently he wasn't as good a billiard player as he thought he was.
Oh, God.
But we don't know the details.
Yeah. That's okay. So the last thing I wanted to ask you here, because we're approaching an hour.
Well, this is pretty wide ranging. I realize, and I'm running at the mouth as I usually do. I apologize.
No. I'm loving it. I wanted to ask you when, because one of the things that that Beethoven had that was not available in Handel's time was the piano, and these technological advances. I'm curious if you think the digital revolution provides any sort of new possibilities for music, or if you've heard any use of electronic instruments that is curious to you.
Well, a couple of things. Remember that in Beethoven's time, Beethoven was one of the first generation who grew up as pure pianist. He played harpsichord when he was very young, but he was basically a pianist. And his whole playing technique was specific to the piano, because it needs to be, and he thought deeply about that. And the piano was rapidly evolving in his lifetime, and his music tracks those changes. So he was the technology of what he had in front of him, which was never, he never was satisfied with, but it's still the nature of the music that he wrote for the instruments was based on what he had in front of him, even to a degree after he was going deaf. Now, modern, I've done electronic music starting back in the 70s when we were using synthesizers and tape recorders. And we did regard it as a major new medium in which you could do absolutely anything sonically. And we believed that to try to ape instrumental music with electronic instruments was not the way to go, because live instruments do that better. Acoustic instruments do that better. So we were writing, you know, wild stuff and luxuriating in all these sounds that could be made only with a synthesizer. And now you can do that with a computer. But the reality is that not that many people, as far as I know, are doing that anymore. The synthesizers and computer music are now used very often just to ape instrumental music. And it's not that interesting to me. It gets better and better. But other resources, like for me as a lousy pianist, most composers, if you're an accomplished musician, you can compose in your head to a degree. But the reality is that most composers, including all the famous composers, mostly wrote at the keyboard. They could write in their heads, often did. Beethoven walked hours a day working in his head. But he did a lot of work at the keyboard. Mozart had to have a keyboard to compose, even though he was perfectly capable of doing without. He just needed it. But people like me, in the first place, when you compose the keyboard, you tend to not write things that a keyboard can't represent, if that makes sense.
Sure.
And meanwhile, somebody like me, who's a mediocre keyboard player at best, is limited by that too. Whereas when you're using software, music copying, you can write something down and it plays it back for you. And to me, that's a great modern resource, because it frees you to a degree from composing at the keyboard. I still compose the keyboard a lot, but I'm not coming up with a lot of the ideas there about the presentation. I'm coming up with the sounds, the harmonies maybe, but I'm letting the software guide me not guide me at all, but I'm letting the software playback help me to create things that can't be represented, that are beyond the piano, beyond the keyboard.
Yeah.
And, you know, very interestingly, people like Brahms would write something, and very often he would have his friends play it back for him so he could listen without his fingers on the keyboard. And Brahms, who was perennially unsure with, you know, a little uncertain with the orchestra, would revise his orchestra music a lot before the premiere and the rehearsals. And most orchestra composers did that. You almost never get it right. You need to hear it and make adjustments. Mahler was fanatical about working over his scores after he'd played them. You know, just massive changes. His wife said at the Eighth Symphony, you could hear almost nothing but percussion. Mahler, who knew more about the orchestra than anybody ever had, completely miscalculated the percussion parts.
Well, that's...
So yeah, I think there are a lot of modern resources. The real resources of electronic music, I think very few people are engaging in. But I think software playback and things like that is very useful. And it also has another use. You can send pieces, you can do a reasonably good mock-up of a score and send it to people before it's been premiered of an instrumental piece. And they can get some idea of what it's like. Whereas before they just had to look at the score. And even people who are very good at looking at scores and seeing things about them can't really figure it all out in their head. It just doesn't work that way. And also things like YouTube, you can put your stuff on YouTube, and that's a whole other way of disseminating your work.
Do you, speaking of which, before we go, do you have anything like that, like a YouTube or a SoundCloud where people can listen to your music?
I have my best piece and the best performance of my life is on YouTube. It's a piece called They That Mourn. I'm going to be putting most of my music on YouTube. I just haven't got around to it yet.
What is the piece called again?
They That Mourn.
Okay.
It's a 9/11 memorial. It's a piece that didn't start off. It was a commission, and it didn't start off. 9/11 hadn't happened when I started it. It happened. I was literally working on the piece when it happened, the beginning of the piece. And I said, do not get involved with that. You cannot try to encompass that in this piece. It's too early. It's too much. And it happened anyway. So that's my 9/11 piece. That's a really fabulous performance on YouTube. And so I'm going to make a page on YouTube. I should be doing it right now, actually.
Finished
the biography of Mozart and sent it off. And now I can have my life again. And doing some stuff with YouTube is very high up there. I need to get it out. Whether anybody will care about it is another question.
Listen, I would love at some point, like you had suggested, to sit down and talk about the popular music that is in your repertoire that you find interesting musically. And those kinds of conversations, if you put them on YouTube, you know, from the perspective of a composer, I think would be really popular.
That's something I've thought about. Webcasts too, and that's why I have this nice mic sitting in front of me. And I might do that. It would probably be more involved with classical music, but I wouldn't mind talking about the pop music that I'm up on, which, and you know, the Beatles are still plenty popular. I mean, sometimes you want to talk about words as well,
right?
Though I have to say that the Beatles are not my favorite popular music when it comes to words.
Really?
Because I think that a certain amount of their words are what I call bullshit for the sake of a rhyme.
Sure, yeah.
They come up with a nice line once in a while, but they're not Cole Porter, if you know what I mean.
Fair enough.
I could also talk about the classic American songs that I know pretty well. A lot of them were written by people who were trained in classical music, like Vernon Duke, who wrote All Things You Are and a lot of other things, was actually Vladimir Dukhelsky, who wrote concert music too.
Yeah, all
so
that.
They were very sophisticated musicians. Gershwin was a tremendously sophisticated musician.
I mean, you think about it, there's got to be some, because the people who are really, if you want to make millions of dollars playing music, I would imagine most of that comes from the popular music landscape. So there are definitely people, at least in these bands, who have gone to music school and who have a deep knowledge of music that they can bring to that. So there's got to be something there, right?
Well, that's an example is Johnny Greenwood, who's doing musical scores now. I mean, movie scores and classical style, because he went to, I guess he majored in composition in college. Whether he has an advanced degree or not, I don't know. But I'll tell you one thing. Most of the people I know age about 50 or younger, composers, classical composers, many of them writing pretty hairy music. Almost all of them started in rock bands in high school. Almost all of them. I didn't, but nearly everybody I know is younger than me did. I had a wonderful conversation with a friend of mine who's, you know, head of a music department. Well, another guy I know is one of the most intellectual serial 12 composers you've ever met. Started off as the lead guitar of a recording band who made Yummy, 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 I've Got Love in My Tummy.
Nice.
And I've got many stories about that stuff. They're hilarious.
Well, Jan, listen, I really enjoyed this.
I always enjoy radio, and I'm glad you're doing these things. I took a look at your website, and there's some fabulous stuff on there. I mean, apparently, though, you can't download your podcasts.
You can. I've got to fix that on my website. If you go to any podcast streaming service, like Apple Podcasts or, you know, Google Podcasts or Spotify or any of these things, you can download it. But yes, you're correct. Off my website.
I walk all the time these days. That's how I stay sane. And I'm trying to get in good hiking shape because I'm an old hiker and now I have time to do it, yada, yada. And I, when I'm doing a real hike for the nature, which is one thing, I certainly don't listen to stuff, but when I'm out somewhere walking to get my miles in to be fit, I listen to podcasts, and I've listened to hundreds and hundreds of hours. So, and I'm frustrated because I have trouble downloading some of the podcasts I want.
Yeah.
It's not often hard to figure out how to do it.
Well, so, what do you use for podcasts?
I often just go directly to the site. I mean, my main things are This American Life, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which is easy. This American Life, you just buy it, though you have to figure out how to do it on Amazon. And Radio Lab, which is also fairly easy.
Yeah.
And Invisibilia is fairly easy. I spent months trying to figure out how to download the second serial broadcast. I finally figured it out, and then somehow it disappeared. You know, suddenly the files were empty. So what's a good service? Let's put it that way.
Well, do you have like a smartphone, like an iPhone or an Android?
I have an Android. Yeah,
I
usually do it on my computer and then download it to my Android, which is easier.
What I would recommend, if you're at all proficient with like downloading apps or anything like that, I would recommend just download the Google Podcast app, because if you download that app, you'll be able to just type in whatever podcast you like This American Life, and it'll just come up, and you can click, you can either stream it, you know, off your Wi-Fi, or you can click download, and it'll just automatically download it on your phone, and you'll just have it. So that's what I would recommend.
Well, I will do that if I have to, because I'd rather have them on my Mac, my desktop.
Yeah.
Because I keep them all. If I put them on my phone, I have a very cheap phone.
I see.
I have to delete them.
I got.
And in fact, I'm now repeating some old podcasts because there are a lot of great ones and there are not enough new ones. Anyway, that's a whole, I'm rambling.
No, not at all. Yeah, it's a worthwhile. I mean, the podcasts are, I was going to say the way of the future, but the way of the present too.
Yeah. Well, podcasts are the more the better, as far as I'm concerned. And I think your interests based on your website are enormous, and that's great. And I thought you had good questions, you know, as they were not floundering around at all.
Well, it's I hope so. I hope this was a worthwhile use of your time. I definitely enjoyed the hell out of it. I love picking people's brains, especially a composer. I've never had a composer on the podcast before, so this was definitely a treat for me.
Well, I'm a composer who writes biographies of composers, and there is nobody else like that.
Exactly. Yeah. When does your Mozart biography come out, by the way?
Presume it's in, and you know, I have to read the line edited version, and then the gallery. Supposedly, it's going to come out in December.
Okay.
And it's actually conceivable that could happen.
Conceivable, yeah. Hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, things tend to get delayed, but they want it out before Christmas, basically, and so. And there's no reason why it shouldn't be, really, from my end. And that was interesting. That's a whole other. I spent 12 years with the Beethoven, and getting Beethoven out of my head and trying to deal with Mozart in his terms was enormously difficult. And whether I succeeded, I don't know.
Oh God, I can't wait to read that though.
Well, if you want to read my best book, read the Charles Ives.
Oh really?
If you want to read the biggest one, read the Beethoven. And the Brahms, to me, the quality of my books is an inverse order to how new they are. The best one is the Ives, which was first. The second best is the Brahms, and then the Beethoven, which is 1,000 pages. And the Mozart, the trouble with Mozart is he didn't have a very dramatic life after his childhood. And his childhood was just, he was, you know, this incredible prodigy. He would just go to one place and play and people would be blown away, and go to the next place and play and people would be blown away.
Right.
And that ultimately is not that interesting either. And he was, all the myths about him being tragic and underpaid and pauper's grave is bullshit. He was enormously well paid. He was very well respected. He was as famous as anybody in music, and he was as well respected. He was not the most popular during his lifetime. If he lived 10 more years, he probably would have been. And he was basically a happy man. He had his problems like the rest of us, but nobody wants, who wants to read about a happy man?
Yeah, exactly.
And I say that in the introduction. That is the problem with his book.
I mean,
and that's why the 19th century ginned up his life into this great Beethovenian tragedy, because that sells books, but it wasn't.
I mean, I don't know. I would still be interested to read a biography of that guy, especially if you go into the music and so on.
To compare it to what happens to celebrities now. I'm actually reading a book about celebrity right now. And it's interesting to compare. Mozart was one of the most famous people in the world at age 6.
Yeah.
He was considered to be a phenomenon of nature and science, a freak of nature. And it's interesting to compare what happens to somebody like that then as now. Some things are similar and other things aren't at all.
I would imagine if Mozart lived in the media environment that we live in now, his life would have taken a much different and maybe unhappier trajectory.
Yes. But well, I would compare that to Wynton Marsalis, who was a fabulous player at age 20, had his own band with his brother in it. And I just said, I don't think this is going to work out very well. Because the earlier generation of jazz people came up playing in clubs, and they got their act together playing for small groups of people in clubs, not for recording. And they worked their way up in terms of fame. But even when they were famous, Charlie Parker mostly still played in clubs where you could experiment and you could grow and you could fall on your face. And Wynton Marsalis was playing for huge audiences from the very beginning. And I just, how do you grow in that situation? As far as I'm concerned, between you and me and the wall, he didn't. Yeah. Even though he's clearly enormously talented and enormously you know, he's a great technician and he's knowledgeable as hell. And yet I'm not interested in his music. Whereas what I heard in live when he was 20, it blew me away. It was fabulous. And it was very innovative, actually. He got less innovative as he got older.
Yeah, people sort of just becoming calcified in the public eye.
Yeah, you grow up in a literal spotlight in front of millions of people. I don't know how you're going to grow. I don't know how you do that. I mean, some people do. Actors do. But I don't know how you do it. That's some guts.
I suppose.
People
I don't
want you to change.
Well, listen, Jan, let's wrap this up. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this. We should.
Well, I'm really looking forward. Do you have a best of? Let me know if you have 5 or 6 podcasts or however many that you think would be good to start with for yours.
Sure. Yeah. I'll, and thanks for bringing up the download thing. Cause I've been meaning to fix that, but, you know, good to hear.
Well, you can't from your website. Let's right. put it that way, as far as I could tell. All right. No, I much enjoyed this. And if we can figure out something else to do sometime, I'd love to do it. And I'll look forward to hearing some of the things. I'm sorry I couldn't stop talking, but.
Not even. That's why I wanted to talk to you.
Okay. So be good and good luck with everything. And let's stay alive.
All righty.
Where are you based?
I'm from Chicago. So that's.
But you're not. Where are you now?
Right now I'm in Bali.
Are you kidding?
No, I've been I've been in Bali, so since the pandemic hit.
Well, have you been involved in the music at all?
No, the only problem is that everything is, Bali is still, it's quietly starting to open back up. But there are certainly no performances happening.
Well, just start listening to music on YouTube and performances and Spotify. And so that when you can finally hear something live, it will be that much more meaningful. Bali is one of the greatest musical traditions in the world. It's phenomenal.
Yeah.
And it's so unique. I mean, it's based on Javanese music, but it's completely itself. And Bali just based, I've always wanted to go there. I'm jealous in a way. Is it a sort of paradise basically?
Pretty much. Yeah. It's funny because I'm on the north end of the island and, it's much more isolated up here. And I was going on a walk the other day and people here will just say like, you know, oh, where are you going? And they don't mean it. You know, like if someone in America stopped me and said, where are you going? I'd be like, you know, why are you asking? But in Bali, they just, it's like, hey, what's going on? And so I'm like, oh, I'm just going on a walk. And they're like, where are you from? And I was basically getting around to telling them that I've been here since the lockdown. And these are not, you know, on the UN global poverty chart, they would probably be in the poorer end of the spectrum. You know, it's a fishing village, but they're able to realize, you know, looking out on the ocean and the palm trees and the nice beaches, they're like, yeah, this is not a bad spot to be locked down, huh? And
are they speaking English?
A little bit. I mean, very, very simple English. I'm trying to pick up some Indonesian, but it's, you know, I'm not great with languages.
Is it incredibly cheap to live there? I know used to be.
Oh yeah. It's like my, where I'm staying, it's like $400 a month, you know?
And it's a house?
Yeah. It's a house and it's literally right on the beach.
Oh God.
I know. Yeah.
Well, that's, I hope I live long enough and survive and after the virus that I can go to Bali. It's something I've always wanted to do. And I want to go to, I've gathered the cities are just hell holes, but the countryside where the music is just fantastic.
Yeah. There's, you know, Bali apparently is opening back up in, they want to say like September or October, to international travel. because they've been pretty good with their lockdown and keeping the virus all under control. And apparently that will include the US. So, I mean, if you've been wanting to do it, I would highly recommend it. I've had a blast.
Well, I'm not going to do it till a vaccine, either that or really, really good treatment.
Yeah.
Because it's just not worth the risk.
Yeah.
I'm 73.
Yeah.
I can have fun. My life is not radically different than it has been for a long time, writing a book at home. So I can take it.
Have you ever considered like selling the rights to a book for like a movie or something like that? I feel like the Beethoven, Charles Ives could, you know what I'm saying?
No, you write books, people write screenplays, and they've been writing screenplays to my books for years here and there. Only a few, but still seriously, but only about 1 in 1,000 screenplays gets produced.
Right.
And I'm actually in contact about Beethoven with a guy who's an Israeli filmmaker, very successful Israeli filmmaker who wants to make a dramatized documentary, a dramedy.
Docudrama.
Docudrama about Beethoven. And who knows? It could happen. If anybody can raise money who I've dealt with, he can. But they still tend not to happen. So yeah. But I've also written a crime novel, and I'm going to try to sell that now under another name. That's not for public consumption. But
why under another name? Why not just put it under?
Because it would confuse people.
You think? Okay.
It's not about music at all. It's a very gritty, sexy, often somewhat bloody novel, and people would just be confused.
Yeah.
But anyway, everybody and their uncle has written a crime novel, so that's a whole other thing. And I tell my publisher or agent about it, and they just groan.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Anyway, I'm rambling. I'm keeping you, and I've got to get outside.
No worries.
So I really enjoyed it. I'll look forward to it. Let me know when it's going up, and I'll share it around a bit.
Great. Thank you once again, Jan, and have a great rest of your day.
Okay, you too. Good luck. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you to Jan Swofford, and thanks for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.